Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Ann Arbor District Library. My name is Tim Grimes. I'm the manager of community relations and marketing at the library, and it's a nice fall afternoon out, so we really appreciate that you're spending it here with us. Thank you so much. This is one of many events that we have here at the library. We hope to see you back for more. We do have these brochures just outside, and you can also check on aadl.org to see about some of our upcoming events. We have lots of lectures, films, concerts. If you come here tomorrow night, we have another author event. It's best-selling author Jamie Ford. He wrote a wonderful book called House at the Corner of Bitter and Sweet, which was a bestseller about the Japanese internment. He's written his second novel, Songs of Willow Frost, and he'll be here tomorrow night at 7. Also on Tuesday night, there's a very interesting documentary that won some Emmy Awards by a Michigan filmmaker called Where Soldiers Come From. It's the story of two Northern Michigan best friends in high school who graduated and then went on to serve in Afghanistan. It's a story of how they served in the war and what happened when they came home. So, and lots more events. Please check it out, aadl.org. But we're very excited about today's speaker. It is actually the 50th anniversary of the death of John F. Kennedy. And there's a wonderful new book out, Dallas, 1963. And we are very, very lucky to have the author here today. Please help me welcome Bill Minutaglio.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming out on a beautiful day. It is beautiful. it's really great to be here. I wanted to say right off the bat that I'm from Texas, just to get that cleared up. So don't hold it against me, okay? My father-in-law, who is a cranky professor at Portland State University in Oregon, used to call me and blame me for everything. Because I was from Texas. Hurricanes, wars, anything you can think of. So again, if you feel that way, forgive me. That's just where I live, and my family does too. But thank you very much. It is really great to be here. And I said, if you have any advice in getting my son into some of the fine schools in the neighborhood, let me know that I could use that, or he could use it. I on the drive over here, I was noticing how beautiful it is, really, just seeing trees, the change color. We don't have that a lot in Texas. They just sort of stay the same color, or they spontaneously combust because of the heat. So, you know, all kidding aside, it's just gorgeous to be here. But then, because I tried to read into too many things, and maybe I'm an armchair psychologist, an armchair meteorologist, and a metaphorical meteorologist, I was thinking about how things sometimes don't change a whole lot in history, in American history, and that leads me to talk about my book, Dallas 1963. A few folks to kind of jump right to the end who have read it have said at times, and perhaps we could talk about this, I'd love to hear what you think, that I could change the title and call it America 2013, at least some parts of it, as opposed to Dallas 1963. So in part, my book might be read as an examination of how sometimes things don't change a whole lot, and but maybe should. But let me just get going, and I'll tell you a little bit about it. I think, boy, talk about a literal exposition there. It's about Dallas in 1963. And actually, it's a bit of a misnomer. It's really about the years, months and years building up to that fateful moment in November of 1963, the 50th we're now celebrating or commemorating, forgive me, the 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's death in Dallas. What we were thinking about, and I say we, I'm not Queen Victoria, I don't normally talk that way. I say we because I co-wrote it with a fellow named Stephen L. Davis, who's a brilliant writer from Texas, and I wish he was here with me to enjoy being here. But he's an old friend. He had grown up in Dallas. I had worked in Dallas at the Dallas Morning News for almost 20 years. And from my window at the Dallas Morning News, I could see the Kennedy assassination site. And when I first moved to Dallas, I lived about two blocks away from the Kennedy assassination site. And I was telling some folks here earlier that I don't know what I was expecting when I moved there. I felt that for a place where something so outsized and dramatic had occurred, that it almost should have been hermetically sealed, as if there should have been a bubble put over this zone. And these famous places that we think of, Dealey Plaza, the Texas School Book Depository, the Triple Underpass, the Grassy Knoll, these names that, you know, if you're of a certain generation, really resonate with you. And I hope are still taught about in schools around America. But I used to walk by the assassination site, and I could see it from my window at work. And what I felt, and I hope this doesn't sound too mysterious or mumbo-jumbo-ish, but I felt that there was really something in the marrow, in the DNA, and even in the shadows in Dallas that had not yet been told about what had happened there 50 years ago. And as I talked to my buddy who grew up there, who had a more, you know, intrinsic, roots-oriented sense of the city, we began saying that, you know, when people think, I think of Dallas, they think of the protagonists, of course, the most obvious, President Kennedy, LBJ, Governor Connally, and then, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby. And people, you know, center on that. And I know many of you here do remember where you were when you heard the news. I remember where I was when I heard the news. But you, so you center around sometimes those figures that you saw on TV and resonating. What Steve and I decided to do was we felt that there was something calling us to write about another protagonist, and that protagonist was the city that in fact we love, called Dallas, Texas. That Dallas in itself was a protagonist. And that's probably, again, that might be a highfalutin literary, you know, reaching for the stars kind of thinking. But we talked about it a lot and really began doing some research and decided that there was no city like Dallas in this time period, in the 3 to 4 years before Kennedy's arrival, that it truly was singular. I'm hopelessly biased in this regard because I wrote a book about it. But I just fail to see how there could have been a more swirling, intense, action-oriented, and frankly, I hate to say it as much as I love Dallas, a vitriolic hatred toward President Kennedy emanating out of the city of Dallas. And not everyone felt that way. I really want to underscore that. That's really just a misnomer. Dallas is not a city of hate. That's too easy. That's low-hanging fruit, low-hanging objectification. There were tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in Dallas who loved Kennedy or respected the office. Our book is about a handful of people, 8 to 10, who I maintain hijacked the microphone. They stole the civic dialogue and ratcheted up the heat, turned Dallas into this roiling hothouse in a way, this place where this virulent and vitriolic set of attacks on Kennedy just multiplied and multiplied and multiplied and inspired in some way. I would rather use the word influenced, inspired, almost, it's too positive sounding. I think had to have influenced Lee Harvey Oswald because he lived in this city and he I think was a very malleable figure and someone subjected to delusions of grandeur. And I'll explain a little bit of this as we move forward. Let's take a look at some images that might help explain this. Let me go back. This is the cover of the book, Dallas 63. Behind it, it says wanted for treason. And that looks like a wanted poster, of course. Does anybody remember this? Remember these floating around? I don't know if these entered history books. Here's the full flyer. These were distributed all around Dallas as Kennedy was arriving in November of 63. This man is wanted for treasonous activities against the United States. He has illegally invaded a sovereign state with federal troops. Kennedy ordered some troops to go to the state of Mississippi to help enforce the integration of the University of Mississippi. He has consistently appointed anti-Christians to federal office. Aliens and known communists abound in federal offices. Number seven down there, it's kind of maybe hard to read in the back. He has been caught in fantastic lies to the American people, including personal ones like his previous marriage, which I'll talk to you about, pretty intriguing. These were created, built, made in Dallas, and distributed on the day of his arrival there, wanted for treason. It's the reason we have it as the cover of our book. So just hopefully to explain where we came up with that. It wasn't just some provocative, sensational invention that we came up with. This was a flyer paid for and distributed by the thousands in the city on the day of his arrival and funded by some pretty strident folks whom I'll talk about who were very powerful as well. This is President Kennedy. This, I hope, proves my point. He's speaking in Dallas in September 1960 to a really big crowd. People loved him there. There were great supporters of President Kennedy. There were a lot of people who didn't like him and weren't going to vote for him. And that's fine, because I think that's sort of the way we do things, isn't it? You could be opposed to someone, but maybe not at the action-oriented level that I think some folks in Dallas had done. But here he is visiting the city. He had come in September of 1960, real quickly, to try to diffuse the sense that was emanating right out of Texas and really in Dallas that he practiced an exotic religion called Roman Catholicism, and that there were folks in Dallas, and I'm going to show you an image of one of these guys, who believed that a Roman Catholic in the White House would be on bended knee to the papacy, and that in fact there really was some sort of almost dark art to Roman Catholicism that might seep out into federal offices and then begin controlling policy, and that it would undermine true Christian values. So Kennedy is in Texas in September 1960, right before at that time, the most contested presidential race in American history, trying to address this and basically to explain to people in Texas and in Dallas, I practice no dark arts. I don't secretly call up the Pope at night and tell him or ask his advice on how to run things. And I won't be doing that as president. That's why he's here. And the big crowd, a lot of people loved Kennedy. LBJ, you might recognize the guy with the requisite LBJ hat, the Stetson that he always had in traveling through Dallas. A lot of smiling faces, obviously Kennedy, another indication of how well-liked they were there. 4 days before the most contested election in a presidential election in presidential history at that time, you're looking at two images. It's a little tricky to see. There's one here. So these are two photographs. Let's start with this one over here. The congressman. Oh, I'm sorry. You told me that, and I wandered. Forgive me. I will stay close to the mic. The gentleman holding the sign that says LBJ sold out to Yankee socialists is the congressman from Dallas. He was considered by some. And I don't know who keeps this list exactly, but he was considered to be the most strident extremist member of Congress, period, end of story, and represented Dallas. He was so extreme in his beliefs that he was the only member of Congress to vote against a free milk program for elementary school children in America, the only one. There had been great uniformity on both sides of the aisle except for him. There had been some surplus milk in America, and some folks said, why don't we give it to poor kids? And I'm not making a political observation. This is just a repertorial observation. And he voted against it because he said it was socialist. That was socialism and getting damn close to communism. So you could perhaps understand where he was coming from. What was happening 4 days before the election is that Bobby Kennedy who was a very intense campaign manager for his brother, John Kennedy, had said, "This election is too dang close. We need to get you, LBJ, down to Texas because we're in danger of even losing Texas. And that can't stand. That's the only reason you're on the ticket." And Bobby Kennedy used more colorful language, and I won't use it here, but he said something about that son of a bee. We put you on the ticket to carry Texas and get down there. It's 4 days before the election. It could go either way. Go down, try to... It makes no sense for us to lose Texas. You're from Texas. And you're the king of Texas, last we heard. So he was sent to Dallas to go give a last-minute speech. And what happened was that the congressman from Dallas knew he was coming, and he laid a trap for LBJ and Lady Bird Johnson, who's in the center of the photograph there wearing the string of pearls. Very demure, elegant in her way, dignified woman. And what happened, and this is an event that really resonated nationally, but it's now been forgotten. It's called the Mink Coat Mob Riot, the Mink Coat Mob Riot in Dallas. At really the instigation of the local congressman, 300 of the leading citizens, many of whom were dressed in mink coats that they had bought from Neiman Marcus, which was just down the block, the famous emporium, came out and waited for LBJ and Lady Bird Johnson to take to the street, to step out of their limousine and to go give a speech, a political rally speech, in the fanciest hotel in Dallas. When that happened, things became unhinged. These are really well-dressed people, the affluent folks of Dallas, the folks from the upper echelons of society and civic discourse. They simply went a little crazy. They began spitting at LBJ and Lady Bird Johnson. They began rushing them with signs, trying to hit them. People were pulling hat pins out of their hats, their pillbox hats, and trying to stab them, ripping off Lady Bird Johnson's white gloves and throwing him in the gutter, calling LBJ a traitor, a Judas, and worse. LBJ, look at the serene look on his face. He's a master of political theater. He knew that this was actually looking pretty good on national television. And so what happened was the extremist congressman was setting a trap 4 days before the election. He thought he could actually derail the Kennedy-LBJ effort, but it completely backfired. The images from this out-of-control riot, this moment, this hysteria in Dallas, were broadcast nationally, and some historians, not I, some true historians, have suggested that that incident, when seen around the nation, helped to actually secure, in some quarters, the election for Kennedy and LBJ. It backfired. People voted in sympathy with LBJ and Lady Bird. They saw this dignified woman being attacked and her husband playing the martyr. So he's the master of political theater. And that, in fact, this unbelievably out of control moment where the police had to get involved. People were wounded, taken to the hospital. It was a melee in the finest hotel in Dallas that had backfired. Years later, Richard Nixon said, "We lost the election. I lost that election because of that a-hole congressman in Dallas." This is the harbinger. Our book kind of begins with this incident in November of 1960. Or really begins to take off as an indication of how different, singular, and overheated things were in Dallas. These two people are interesting because of their superlative nature. The man over here, who's a little bit less in focus with the young lady behind him, that's his daughter, is the world's richest man. It's H.L. Hunt, the world's richest man at the time, a billionaire. He lived in Dallas. He loathed Kennedy. He hated Kennedy. He believed that Kennedy was driving the country to socialism and, frankly, was going to completely undermine the oil industry in the United States. What's fascinating, and he spent millions and millions of his own dollars creating what I maintain was the birth of extremist radio in America. He created a radio broadcast called Lifeline that was heard every day by 10 million people around the nation, and it was basically an endless set of diatribes against Kennedy. Just blasting Kennedy, blasting, calling him a socialist. This is, I think, a fascinating photograph because he's at a book signing party H.L. Hunt. And he's just written a book, and he's at a store in downtown Dallas. And those are his daughters behind him. They're kind of celebrating the book. But his book was his manifesto of how the United States should be altered and changed. And it's sort of this utopian novel, but it was really his blueprint for how America should be run. And so if you read the book, it's a little hard to find these days. You will note that one of the things that H.L. Hunt, the world's richest man, funding, bankrolling the anti-Kennedy efforts in the city of Dallas, was suggesting that people who were in the lower income brackets in America, the 40% and lower wage earning bracket in America, should not be able to vote. I want to let that settle for a second there. So that would mean I couldn't vote. So, but that wealthy folks could vote up to 7 times, and that if you had, you could also purchase more votes if you had some disposable income. So, and again, I'm not practicing class warfare here. I'm just suggesting to you that that was part of his. He suggested that should be part of the new United States Constitution. And baked into the Constitution, by the way, as a permanent part of the new American Constitution should be an oil depletion allowance, which some people have characterized as a tax loophole for oilmen. But more significantly, he believed that the more money you had, the more often you could vote. An interesting concept. I don't think it took off. So the gentleman on the other side was his preacher. That was the man that whom he went to for spiritual guidance at church. His name is Reverend W.A. Criswell. And he became really the spiritual leader, I would maintain, in America against Kennedy. And where does he live? He's the leader of First Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas. You see this rather singular storm brewing, this coalescing of these amazing figures. So he heads the largest Baptist congregation in America and travels the nation, and he's very well known. One of the members of his congregation, an aide, is Reverend Billy Graham. This is not an insignificant man, Reverend W.A. Criswell. A lot of folks have forgotten him. Through the 1950s, he was a staunch anti-integrationist. He referred to folks who supported integration. After the Supreme Court's ruling in 1954 ordering public school desegregation, he said, up in Washington, they're infidels. Let them integrate. Let them wear their dirty shirts and integrate. I'm not sure what he meant by the dirty shirts, but he was also extremely, this is a guy I was alluding to earlier, he really believed that there was something about Roman Catholicism that would undermine true Christian values in the United States, and issued or spoke from the pulpit in a great thundering speaker, captivating speaker, and Hunt loved him and vice versa. Hunt especially loved him. H.L. Hunt, world's richest man, loved him so much that after one of Criswell's especially virulently anti-Kennedy speeches, decided to print up 200,000 copies of it and send it to pretty much every Protestant minister in America. And it was distributed, and the FBI got a little interested in that because that seemed to them to be some sort of quasi-illegal campaign literature that needed to be examined and investigated. And Hunt went into a little bit of hiding. He had had these broadsides printed up in New York to create a little bit of distance. But you see what's happening here. You've got different folks, again, coalescing. This is a gentleman. The gentleman over there with the white hat is standing in front of the building that I used to work at. Let's see, from his perspective, a little to his left was my window. So I know where this is. Let's start, though, with the statue. That's a famous statue, at least in Dallas, maybe American history. That's Dealey Plaza. Back behind it is a pretty famous building, the Texas School Book Depository. You can almost see the window up on the sixth floor from which Lee Harvey Oswald, we believe, fired on the president. George Batterman Dealey was a crusading publisher known in the South. He was the publisher of the Dallas Morning News. This is the gentleman in the statue here. He was known probably best for driving the Ku Klux Klan out of Dallas. This is another little-known fact, I think, about the city. The national headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan in America, probably at its most active and aggressive public manifestation, was in Dallas, Texas. It was not in some other, you know, if you look at a map and we think of deep southern cities, it was in Dallas, Texas. Dallas is one of those uniquely southern and western cities. The southern element has really been forgotten, I think. This gentleman, the statue, he drove them out of town. He said they're no good for business. They'd been parading in town. There were tens of thousands of members, public members, the mayor, the people who ran the most prominent banks and so forth in town. And he chased them out of town with the help of that guy over there, and that's his son, Ted Dealey, who was a Cub reporter at the time. George Bannerman Dealey retired. His son became the publisher. He's standing in front of the Dallas Morning News building. Ted Dealey developed the sense, particularly after World War II, that the U.S. Was in danger, that we were going to succumb to the Russian bear, that and that socialism was encroaching, it was creeping up into the highest levels of government, and that it was part of a cloth, that we were being confronted with a war that could heat up, a literal war, a hot war, but the Cold War was also insidiously taking root. And part of it involved integration in what some people, I think, broadly would call progressive movements. And really what he saw is big government intrusion on states' rights. And he became really sort of the microphone, because he was the most powerful media magnet in Texas, arguably in the South. I could argue that. His paper was extremely influential and read and imitated by other newspapers. But he became the guy that really used the media to attack Kennedy. Not only that, and here's I think it's fascinating. I'm heavily biased, forgive me, about what I think is fascinating in my book. Why wouldn't I be? But Ted Dealey so much loathed President Kennedy that he went directly to the Kennedy White House to a lunch with Kennedy and berated him in person. Kennedy had invited a number of publishers to come to the White House for a luncheon just to meet and, a little bit of mutual politicking. Let's flatter the publishers. Maybe they'll write nice things about them. The publishers feel maybe we can go to the White House, get a little bit more firsthand information. We're going to go to the mountaintop. And these things happen all the time. Publishers go up and then they dance with the president. And the president dances with them. That's always happened. Dealey got invited and decided on his way up. I was looking at his handwritten notes that I had come across in an archives. He stayed up late the night before he was going to meet with Kennedy, and in what seemed to be rather fevered scrawl, he was writing in pencil on some hotel stationery at the hotel in Washington. He was basically saying, this is my chance. I'm going to be in the room with President Kennedy. I'm going to be this far away from him, and I'm going to yell at him, and I'm going to tell him what he needs to know, that he's not hearing from the heartland. And he did. In the middle of a lunch, there people were enjoying things and having a nice lunch, and Kennedy was a lot of witty repartee. Suddenly, Dealey stands up and begins yelling at the President of the United States. And what does he tell him? He says, you're just like your daughter, Caroline. You're just a little girl on a tricycle. You're not a man on horseback. You're weak-willed. And this country is going to be annihilated because you are like Caroline riding a tricycle. And he went on. He said, you're afraid to drop a bomb, aren't you? You're afraid to annihilate the enemy. And Kennedy was staggered, and as were many of the other publishers, many of whom perhaps even felt the same way, but just simply thought it lacked decorum in the White House to accost the president that way. And he was reviled, a lot of folks. It made national headlines for a while, and Kennedy jokingly said, cancel my subscription to the Dallas Morning News. So he lost a customer, but he was a very tough-minded man who didn't like Kennedy. The other thing, the personal animus, this goes back to the Wanted for Treason poster that I showed you earlier. I saw a couple of raised eyebrows going, what was that bit on the treason poster about Kennedy's marriage? Dealey got obsessed with this rumor that was circulating in Washington and other certain anti-Kennedy circles that President Kennedy had been married once before prior to being married to Jacqueline Kennedy. And I'm not making this up, that there was a rumor that he had been married once before and that somehow or other the marriage not just was annulled, it was disappeared. That because the Kennedy dynasty had the power and influence to do this, that somehow or other the paperwork for it was destroyed, vanished, as if it had never occurred, as if it had never occurred. And again, I'm not making this up. There was an active group of people around the nation who were pursuing this rumor. The great Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, later on, many years later, was still investigating this rumor. So it was an active rumor back then. And Ted Dealey ordered his reporters to investigate it. So he had a personal animus, I think, in my opinion. Again, I worked at the Dallas Morning News, so in that building. I think he just took it to another level. He was opposed to Kennedy at all fronts. And there, I found a lot of documentation in his archives where he ordered his reporters find the truth out about that marriage. I know he was married before, and we need to know it because it's part of the continuing lie that the Kennedys are projecting. Boy, this is General Edwin, Major General, former Major General Edwin Walker, who here is on the cover, obviously, of Newsweek. General Edwin Walker is famous in American history for leading the troops, being in charge of the troops that helped to lead the integration of public schools immediately in the wake of the Brown v. Board of Education decision. Incredibly watershed moment in American history. He was sent to Little Rock, Arkansas to help escort black students into schools that they had been prohibited from attending. And he was the guy that was going to provide the armed escort with thousands of federal troops. So he led them. So a World War II hero, a major general, career military officer. After that happened in the mid-50s, he had deep, deep recriminations. He began thinking that, in fact, integration of the public schools was a denial of states' rights, what he called Southern traditions, and that attended to that, it was probably part of this conspiracy in the United States by socialists and even communists to undermine the American way of life, that it was wrong, it was even biblically wrong. He would resort to things in the Bible to back up his argument. No good came of his beliefs. He began publicly telling his troops. He commanded a large group of troops in Europe in the 1950s, the U.S. presence, troops in Europe, a big tens of thousands of troops. And word began seeping back to Washington, to Eisenhower and then Kennedy, that General Walker was telling his troops how to vote and that he was providing them, frankly, with extremist propaganda, propaganda that was suggesting, I think, you know, pretty intense things, that President Harry Truman was a socialist, that former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt was a socialist. And he was giving this kind of intense extremist literature to his troops, telling them how to vote. Not good. and then pushing further and further to attacking eventually President Kennedy. No good came of this career-wise because he was essentially defrocked and expelled from the military. He, in his way, when that happened, became really the lightning rod in some ways, the national lightning rod for the anti-Kennedy movement. He's a major general. He had been a World War II hero. And in fact, it had been a hero in some estimations in helping to integrate public schools in America. So many people thought he was making, he had been a warrior. And maybe he really was the man on horseback, not, you know, Caroline on the tricycle. Maybe this was the guy. And the reason I bring him up is that he moved to Dallas. When he was expunged from the military for basically disobeying his commander-in-chief, he decided to move to Dallas. He could have picked anywhere in the world to move to, but he came to Dallas, Texas, because it was a welcoming environment because of all these other folks who were there. Here he is being greeted by the mayor. We do this a lot in Texas. I'm sorry I didn't bring a cowboy hat to give you, but we gift each other with these things. So the mayor is giving General Walker a cowboy hat. The mayor is really interesting and indicative. His name is Earl Cabell. His grandfather had been a very prominent Confederate general, and there's a big memorial, a giant Confederate memorial and monument in downtown Dallas. One of the largest statues of Robert E. Lee in America is in Dallas. This is part of our ties to the South that a lot of folks tend to forget. Not all cowboys in Dallas. But so his grandfather, the mayor, had been a Confederate general, and then his own father had been mayor, and now he's a third-generation mayor. And I just mention that because it shows how tightly woven Dallas is, and there's a sort of generational consistency there. And this gentleman, you know, when he would walk to work, he could walk by a monument to his father, the former Confederate general who had become mayor. And so it's part of a cloth, and now he's giving a hat to a gentleman who's espousing the protection of Southern traditions. Segregation is really what we're talking about. So he was truly welcomed at an enormous public ceremony. He was given the keys to the city. Now you begin to see all these forces, you know, pulling together in the city of Dallas. So not just to leaven our story for a relief from maybe this grinding coalescing, but to be accurate. To be accurate, I really did want to underscore in our book the fact that there were other people who weren't as extreme in Dallas, and there were many, 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 tens of thousands, as I said, if not hundreds of thousands. And here's one that's kind of famous. I don't know. Do you know the store Neiman Marcus? Okay, it's, you know, our best store and the most famous store. There must be an equivalent here in Michigan that I'm unaware of. Forgive me, but it's our finest emporium. They're famous for putting out a catalog. Maybe some of you see it. They put it out every Christmas that has the most outrageous and expensive gifts imaginable. His and her airplanes and you know, interesting things. But that's Stanley Marcus, who ran the finest store, I'll go all the way, in the South. And it was really, really affluent, really, really wealthy. Many of the mink coats worn by the mink coat mob, whom I showed you earlier, were bought at his store. He had a vault that he kept downtown to, air control or temperature control vault to house mink coats, and there were 20,000 of them in there. So he was doing okay, and that's Coco Chanel over there trying on a hat. Stanley Marcus was probably the most, he was a Harvard-educated man who happened to be Jewish. I mention that because he, by dint of being Jewish, he was excluded for most of the private clubs in town. Blacks and Jews were still excluded at this time, so the early 1960s. Yet most of his customers were the affluent, powerful people in town. He made monogram bathrobes for LBJ. LBJ didn't like the monogram in his and sent it back to him and had him redo it. He made Mamie Eisenhower's inauguration dress. So, interesting and powerful guy. And the reason I'm showing this to you is that he was also a spy. I like saying that because it's provocative. But he really loved Kennedy, and he really loved LBJ, and he really loved the thought that Dallas needed to be catapulted out of what he thought was the Civil War era into a more modern era and become more internationalist and needed to be less xenophobic. He wanted dialogue. He wanted art. He brought Pablo Picasso paintings to the Dallas Museum of Art, and people in the city went nuts because they thought it was communist art. So Stanley was, by Dallas estimations, was a very progressive man. And the reason I say he's a spy, his best customers were the people whom he was diametrically opposed to politically. But he had to serve them. They were his customers. Otherwise, he'd go out of business. So he's a very interesting man, and very quietly, but aggressively, he was very wealthy. He was funding the pro-Kennedy LBJ forces in the city. Couldn't really talk about it a whole lot. But he gave away a lot of money, and you'll see in another slide, if I get to it, how he did that. And very interesting man. The backstory, I think this is true, you know, of any city. I do live in Texas. I've been there forever, but I was born in New York, and I also say don't hold that against me as well. But I was born in New York. I grew up in Texas, and I could tell you that, you know, obviously racism and the battle over civil rights took place in everywhere, right? So it's not just a Southern thing. We know that. Forgive me for even mentioning it. But the woman boarding the train is Juanita Kraft, and the reason she's in our book is that she was leading, along with another gentleman who will be in the next slide, the push for integration in Dallas. Here's another negative superlative to throw at you. Dallas in this time period was the last major American city to not integrate its public schools. It wasn't Birmingham, Alabama, or other places whom you might want to, you know, put on your short list, forgive me, for anybody here from Alabama or Birmingham, but I you know what I'm getting to here. I don't think people know that Dallas was the last major American city to resist public school integration. And this is into the 1960s, by the way, a few years after the Supreme Court said that was the law of the land. But she really helped to lead integration and was really, I'm going to go all the way here, be a little dramatic, the Rosa Parks of Texas. She's boarding a train, so it's a good image for us to include in the book, not on this train, but on another train as she traveled around Texas trying to recruit particularly young people, teenagers, to join the NAACP and to help register older folks to vote and so on. She sat in the whites-only section of a train in Texas, and the conductor came to her and said, if you don't move, I'm going to issue not just behavior modification, but Texas-style justice. And he was essentially suggesting he was going to order the train pulled to the side of the road and she would be lynched. And it was investigated by the NAACP and other folks. Nothing ever came of it, but that's who she was. And she was living in the city of Dallas, an ardent pro-Kennedy supporter, didn't really have access to the microphone like some of those other folks whom we saw, or the pulpits, but she was doing her bit to help Kennedy get elected, and a great odds. She lived in a neighborhood in Dallas that was frequently bombed because it was an area that was being integrated. Very interesting. I've totally forgotten. By the way, Kennedy knew about her, and she was invited this woman right here was invited to the White House more often than anybody else from Dallas during the Kennedy administration. She went 3 times. To meet the president and Jacqueline Kennedy, because he knew of her efforts. He was courting her a little politically. LBJ was saying there's something called the black vote. We might want to think about getting it. So this picture is a little hard to see. The gentleman that's over here in less focus, his name is H. Rhett James, and he also was leading the civil rights movement in Dallas. And his hell-bent mission was to do something that nobody in Dallas wanted, particularly the gentleman we saw earlier. He wanted to bring Martin Luther King to Dallas to speak. And Dr. King had not been to Dallas except for a brief visit back in the mid-50s to give a 20-minute speech to a youth group. It was hardly a political appearance. By this time period, in getting into 1963, Dr. King obviously was a national figure. And there's some anecdotal evidence that folks were really warning Dr. King, don't go to Dallas, don't go there, it's just too overheated. And this gentleman, again, you can hardly see him, he's the pastor of the leading largest black church in Dallas. It was a church founded by slaves, had made it his mission to reach out to Dr. King and as well to the Kennedy White House. He was in constant correspondence with LBJ, a preacher in Dallas, constantly sending him missives about what was going on in Dallas, the activities of these other men who are extremists. And he finally succeeded in luring Dr. King to Dallas for an extraordinary moment, I think, in Dallas history. So here he is here. You can see him in better definition. He's the guy that's closest to me with these right here, the striped tie. And then there's Dr. King. This is in January of 1963. Think about that. Think about being in the year 1963. We're marching, we're counting down to November 22nd. Dr. King comes to Dallas, and what happens? There's a bomb threat against him. There's a bomb threat against him. He obviously didn't come to fruition, thank goodness, but it's another little indication. You have these riots going on earlier, LBJ being attacked, Lady Bird Johnson. Dr. King finally comes. And the focus of his speech, by the way, was harmony. It was as simple as that. I studied the speech. He was talking about let's stop the polarization. Let's stop yelling at each other. To me, I'm skipping ahead. It sounds a little like 2013, if I may say that. But let's stop screaming at each other. Can we talk at least? Let's at least talk. There was a bomb threat lodged against him, you know, in Dallas. This is a dramatic headline. The key part there for us is ex-General Walker is held for insurrection. You know, while people were pushing for integration, from his headquarters, General Walker moved into a mansion in the most affluent part of the city, and then presumed that he would probably run for the presidency, that he would dethrone Kennedy. And one of the ways that he was going to do was to jumpstart the anti-integration movement in America. And what he did, he left Dallas. Several of his colleagues, his supporters, were driving over to the University of Mississippi to begin to protest against the attempt by James Meredith to integrate the University of Mississippi, a watershed moment in American civil rights history. And Walker decided, I'm going there. I'm leaving Dallas. And many of his followers were going with him. Well, one of them was stopped en route by the police, and they found unbelievable amounts of weapons, thousands of rounds of ammunition. They were going to war. They were going to war. And this is unbelievable. He essentially instigated a riot at the university. People were killed. Hundreds were wounded. And it resulted in him, at the direct order of President Kennedy, Kennedy said, ordered troops to arrest former Major General Edwin Walker for insurrection, for sedition, and to hold him in a federal psychiatric facility. An amazing moment. I mean, you just look at the size of the headline. The New York Times thought of that grave to devote this huge thing. And this is a man from Dallas. He's now not thinking, I'm just going to be issuing speeches in Dallas. I'm going to use Dallas as my national headquarters to, I'm going to go all the way, overthrow President Kennedy. He was arrested. A very prominent lawyer from Dallas got him released. And this is him being welcomed back in Dallas at the airport. And it's Walker for President, 1964. And you can see how supported he is there. And they're flying some Confederate flags. So here we are now. I don't have to tell you this is, but I will. Lee Harvey Oswald. Why is he next? Oswald had moved to Dallas at about the same time that General Walker had returned to Dallas from that incident in Mississippi, and became obsessed with General Walker and what he thought was the rise of fascism in Dallas, and that he believed that General Walker was leading the nation down a fascist highway. And this is something else that's been exiled, I think, to the dustbin of history. Some of you here know this, maybe some don't, so I'll just say it. Oswald's attempted assassination of Kennedy was not his first assassination attempt. In April of 1963, he crept into an alleyway in Dallas behind a mansion where General Walker lived in the dark of night, found a fence, a white picket fence, upon which he could rest his rifle, waited until General Walker appeared in a window of his house and sat down at his desk to work on some papers, and Oswald tried to blow his head off and shot. The bullet hit the windowsill. And was diverted just enough to miss Walker. It was a headshot. Lee Harvey Oswald in April of 1963, a very malleable, I believe, and I think a lot of folks who've tried to do armchair psychology about him, a very malleable, impressionable person who wanted to take his place on the world stage. He wanted to make history. He was disappointed that the world in some ways hadn't noticed that he had defected, former Marine, marksman who has defected to Russia hadn't been made of that. I think he was disappointed. And again, I'm now being an armchair psychologist. But he came back and he decided to kill the person who many people, Newsweek magazine said was the most extreme political figure in America and came this close to killing him. And I think a lot of folks have forgotten that story, that there were a lot. This is in Dallas, Texas. This is, by the way, it's the nicest part of Texas. It's a beautiful, beautiful part of Texas where this general lived. I almost killed him. And I wonder, don't you, if that had happened, if there would have been a full-on investigation into the assassination of General Walker, and would it have led to this man being captured? And then November 22nd might not have happened. It's pretty, for fate and circumstance, pretty staggering. All in Dallas, Texas. It's just an amazing convergence. Also going on in Dallas, I'm going to speed it up here, forgive me. There were these other grassroots groups that were welling up. This one is a scene from something called the National Indignation Convention, which is that when I say that, it always engenders that it's just a funny name. They called it the National Indignation Convention, but its sphere of influence was only in Dallas. And when they tried to broaden it, they began calling it the National Indignation Convention. And people were saying, well, that's just too many, nationals. They were virulently anti-Kennedy. The John Birch Society, some of you know what that is, was really one of the great manifestations of extremist politics, I think, in American history, modern American history. The guy who started the National Indignation Convention in Dallas said, that John Birch Society is too damn liberal. In fact, he used the word taint. They have a liberal taint about them. And he very aggressively said, we are the most extremist organization in America. And we wanted that underscored. So they held giant political rallies. And of course, their standard bearer, the guy they rallied around, was General Edwin Walker. They're headquartered in Dallas. And what's happening with them is they're folks who are a little bit below the cloud line. They're not as powerful in some ways, but they become really sort of the street-level soldiers for some of this activity, the distribution of the wanted for treason posters and things like that. But there you can see. So I'm marching forward here. I hope this is somewhat chronological. January of 63, a bomb threat in Dallas against Martin Luther King. April of 1963, an attempted assassination of General Walker, who desperately, go all the way, really wanted Kennedy out of the White House. Thought we were doomed. The United States was doomed. So April 63, Oswald tries to assassinate, the swirling violence. Around the same time period, by the way, early and mid 1963, swastikas are showing up all over Dallas. They're plastered on Neiman Marcus because Stanley Marcus, who runs it, is Jewish. There's a Holocaust survivor named Jack Oren, someone whom I was lucky to interview late in his life. At this time period, came home from work one day. He had been, quote, operated on by Dr. Mengele. And I'm not going to go into the details. It was just horrific what happened to this man, a Holocaust survivor, relocated to Dallas. He's coming home from work in early 1963, and there's a cross burning on his lawn. Little children in the nearby city of Fort Worth are being stopped by the police outside a temple, a Jewish temple, and they're found to be wearing armbands with swastikas. And they have bags of gunpowder, and their plan, these are children, one of them was 12, their plan was to blow up the synagogue. Things were just reaching this crazy point. Forgive me for the long introduction to this. It's hard to see. October 25th, 1963, this is the LA Times, so this has made national news. At Stanley Marcus's invitation, he just desperately wanted Dallas to be liked. It was good for business. But he just wanted it to not be seen as a place full of extreme, this anger, this hate. He decided he would invite the very erudite and elegant United Nations ambassador from the United States, Adlai Stevenson, former presidential candidate, former governor, to Dallas to speak. And he's as I've listened to his speeches and seen, video of them, a rather calm presence. And almost soothing in his way, even if you don't agree with him politically. But he was invited to the city to suggest that Dallas could move beyond this kind of vitriol and should take its place on the national stage and the international stage. And what happens in October of 1963, almost exactly 1 month before President Kennedy is going to hop on a plane and come to Dallas, Stevenson gets attacked, just as the mink coat mob had once attacked Lady Bird in LBJ. Right in downtown Dallas, people lunge at him. They hit him. One of them struck him with a stick, hit him, you know. People, you see bodies are on the floor over here. The police had to intercede. There were arrests. People were spitting. Stevenson, again, usually very unflappable, extremely erudite, very diplomatic, United Nations ambassador, was scared for his life. He was terrified. Stanley Marcus saved his life, some people say. He grabbed him by the lapel, threw him in a waiting car. They made a getaway. And these are, by the way, again, this sort of, you know, some of the folks from the nicer part of town, you know, these folks that had just got so possessed with rage, anger, they had moved well beyond, you know, just sort of yelling. Now they were attacking. Stanley Marcus grabs the UN ambassador, the United States, in downtown Dallas. The UN ambassador pulls him in a car, says, "Get out of here," to the driver. They speed away, and Stevenson is shaking, and he turns to Stanley Marcus and says, "My God, are these animals or are they humans?" And national headlines, Los Angeles Times, it went around the nation, yet again, a black eye for the city. And it's just a strident minority. They stole the microphone. These are the leaders of Dallas. And I bet this isn't too uncommon in many other cities. Most of these aren't elected officials. These are the folks that are the prominent businessmen. This is called the Dallas Citizens Council. And they're really, you know, the more powerful, influential folks, bankers, insurance executives, and many of them eminently logical and civic-minded. They had a great hand in deciding who would get elected. They were sort of the citizen kings, if you will, and I don't mean that in a truly negative or pejorative way. They were just very powerful. They cared about the city. It was enlightened self-interest for them to have Dallas known as a nice, receptive place. And in the wake of the Adlai Stevenson attack, it had just been a horrific year. Bomb threat, Martin Luther King, attempted assassination of General Walker, swastikas, crosses burned, the UN ambassador fearing for his life in downtown Dallas. They got together and said, enough is enough. We have to begin distancing ourselves from this extremism in Dallas. We have to come out publicly and say, "General Walker, please go away, please stop," and everyone else who's being this histrionic and this virulent, "Please stop. It's enlightened self-interest for all of us, by the way. It's good for business. We need to restore the image." But I maintain, and I don't mean to be too provocative, by then it was too late. And here we go. On the day of the assassination, some of you might remember this too, some of General Walker's supporters in town and people who really just supported this extreme movement went down to the Dallas Morning News and placed this ad, which, you know, in retrospect was just horrific and just awful. It's just almost sickening in a way, because it says, "Welcome Mr. Kennedy to Dallas." What you can't see, it's a little difficult, it's just a number of accusations. It's an attack. And what some people have said that is that it looks like an obituary because it's bordered in black. The ad, some people say, would normally never have run in the paper, but that Ted Dealey, the gentleman I had shown you earlier, who had gone to the White House and yelled this far away from Kennedy, and then it also investigated his marriage, ordered this ad run and said, "This reflects what we feel." And so it ran in the paper. And many people have said, well, this is truly symbolic of a city of hate. But again, I really do want to underscore that this is the act of a you know, a powerful minority. I already told you what this was. That same day, all over the city, and police and advanced security teams for Kennedy were beginning to be worried. This seemed to be really pushing the envelope. Because what's the penalty for treason? Yeah, so forgive me, I've slipped into professor mode there. But thank you. Yeah, it can be death. And this scared people. And waiting for him You see, let's bury King John. Again, I think an unfortunate side, bury Goldwater, but let's bury him. You could read into that as you wish. We're getting toward the end here of our slides, and of course, that's the image of Kennedy at Love Field. And a few minutes later, he'll be assassinated in downtown Dallas. And that's back to the cover of the book. So thank you for indulging me. I'm a college professor, and I wax on. I was telling somebody earlier, one of the best instructor survey forms I ever got. You know, students are allowed to judge you. They write survey forms at the end of it. How'd you do? I don't like that part of democracy. But one of them said, more guest speakers. So I took that as a reflection. So I indulged. I said, if that's what you want, that means less work for me. I'll bring in more guest speakers. But if you have any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
If you have a question, just hold up your hand. I'll come around with the mic. Okay.
I can't promise that I'll be able to answer, but I'll give it a shot.
Well, just a little bit of background. I noticed on the Wanted for Treason poster, it was talking about Kennedy betraying our friends in Portugal and Katanga and befriending our enemies in places like Yugoslavia and Poland,
God forbid.
Why is there any particular reason why they were choosing those particular countries at that time? What was Kennedy doing with Katanga?
And I'm going to profess to not, I'm a journalist, and I don't like when politicians begin going back and forth. But your question was about the specificity, in case some of you hadn't heard it, the specific countries that were mentioned in the literature, including Katanga and Portugal, as you said, and Yugoslavia. Basically, in a nutshell, to wrap it up, that there was a sense that these were post-colonial environments, that there were socialist tendencies going on, and that we needed to be wary in terms of transitions of government, and the U.S. wasn't doing enough to ward off really encroaching, not socialism, but communism particularly. That's a real broad-based answer. The Yugoslavia one really hit close to home. Do you remember the photograph of the man going like this? That was the National Indignation Convention. One of the things that they were really upset about was that they couldn't figure out why some pilots from Yugoslavia were being allowed to train, particularly in Texas. That just didn't go over too well. So there was this sense that we needed to monitor any bit of encroaching socialism, especially as there was this turbulent changeover of governments around the world. And again, there's probably someone in this room who could give you a more effective answer, but it was a very good question.
And we have one right here.
You alluded to it earlier and throughout your presentation, but take us to 2013 and the parallels, which we can all guess at. But the New York Times ran an interesting piece yesterday about how popular Ted Cruz is now in Texas.
Yeah, you know, I don't know what you think of the media, you know, but some people in the media. We purport to be some of us do objective, you know, and I don't know. There are whole courses taught about the media's agenda, and that's a given, but I'll start this way. I was thinking about this on my flight up out of Texas, and Ted Cruz, he's in the news a lot, right? And he really seems to have become the lightning rod for a way of thinking. He happens to be, from Texas, which is interesting. He happens to be, an articulate man, eloquent. He happens to be Ivy League educated. And I don't know what handsome means. I know that I'm not, so... but he has this ease about him, I would say. And that's exactly like Bruce Alger, the gentleman who was the very strident extremist congressman. He was also Ivy League educated, went to Princeton, but was an effective public speaker and had this bearing and way about him and seemed to advocate many of the same things. So that's one way of beginning to answer your question. I've had people give me advice about what to say as I go on my national book tour, which is interesting, and some of them are quite craven. in trying to be provocative. And I'll just relay this to you. So perhaps by framing it that way, I've distanced myself from what I'm about to say. But I met someone at the University of Virginia in Washington as part of my book tour who said, you need to begin just saying the words, the Tea Party was born in Dallas in 1963. And he said, you'll sell a lot more books. And I said, well, I don't know that that's right. I don't know that I'm prepared to say that. It's obviously intentionally provocative. And again, I'm trying to answer this in a non-political way. But I would suggest that, you know, the sense certainly of protecting, states' rights, resisting what some people call federal oversight, to try to choose as neutral a term as possible, that there was encroaching socialism. I'll go really far and get very specific. Medicare, when it was evolving at this time period, and President Kennedy was espousing a national health care plan, people on an extreme level were suggesting that's tantamount to a government death panel. And those are words that have been used, unless I'm a totally failed reporter. I'm just an old hack newspaper guy, but I've heard those terms used. And again, I'm trying to be objective. But there were folks who said back then, this is encroaching, federal control over literally our lives, our health. And so I think, it seems I'm hearing some of those echoes today. So it's a really legitimate question. And then, the underpinning of it, almost the moral impulse and even spiritual impulse. I live in Texas, and I think we still call it the buckle of the Bible Belt down there. And we have, in Dallas particularly, we used to have the largest congregations in each denomination. We always say we're bigger than any, and everything, good and bad, I suppose. But the largest, Presbyterian and Baptist congregation, I don't know, again, because I'm not a student of the Tea Party or really even, to be honest, the 2013 politics. I'm just not as conversant as many of you would be. But I think there's parallels. And by the way, now I'm not being political and careful, but I just believe this. It's my opinion. The extremism is on both sides. I was telling somebody the other day, and it's so simplistic. I have a TV set that has the ability to have a little picture of another station down in the corner. Do you know what I mean? The picture in the picture. And I only kind of discovered that I had it. I'm a little old-fashioned. So I rather enjoy, I don't know that I enjoy it. But I'll put MSNBC on and then Fox News down here. And it almost seems like they're yelling at each other on my TV set right there in my living room. And then for fun, I'll minimize one and make the other larger. And back on planet Earth where things are serious, the parallel to me is that back then it seemed like a handful of people, again, hijacked. I'm redundant here, forgive me. My book isn't. Please buy it. It's never redundant, but that there was just this yelling and this polarization, and that people who were somewhere, the greater majority who were somewhere in the middle, still had a lot of respect, for folks in power. I'm going to go all the way, whether it was President Bush or President Obama, but the level of vitriol is, in my opinion, it's untenable. And one reason that it disappoints me, I feel I have two children. One is 20. A daughter is 20 and a son is 15, and I feel them being inured. They don't want to be citizens in a way. They see this anger, and it's not interesting or pleasant to them. It doesn't seem constructive. I gave you a big speech, and I'm not running for office. I would never be elected.
A couple more questions up here. We're going to start right here in the middle.
Hi, I've got two questions.
Great.
The first one is, President Kennedy announced the Peace Corps on the steps of the University of Michigan Union near to here.
Wow.
And so in your researches of the kinds of more progressive folks that you mentioned, did you find student organizing or more of those organizing looking to the international positive ties he was making?
Yeah.
And the second question is more about your methodology. That you took the city as a character I have to admit, the only thing I remember about Kennedy's assassination was one picture from his funeral. Right. But I was in India when Mrs. Gandhi was assassinated.
Oh. Hmm.
So can you talk something about the method of looking at the city as a protagonist and how you went about finding the information?
Okay.
Because that might inform looking into other assassinations in other places and times.
Those are really good questions. Thank you. The first one, and I'll try to answer that. I hope I understood it correctly. And tell me, please, yell at me. Don't throw anything, but tell me, and I'll try to answer. But and by the way, I didn't know that about the Peace Corps and where we are.
Medallion on the stairs.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, that's just fantastic. Thank you for letting me know that. I like to learn, too. In Dallas, again, just as a nod to some – the book is hyper-centered on Dallas. It really is. We move a little bit outside to look at other cities, Houston and San Antonio. And then what you'll see in it, if you have the patience to look through it and endure it, as I say, is that it's completely chronologically driven. It's really written in a calendar entry style. So it effectively begins in January of 1960, and then month by month, and the chapters are titled, January 60 and October 63 and so forth. And what we saw in Dallas, and again, not intentionally to leaven the story, but to, I think, shine the light on things that had been forgotten because Dallas had been castigated as a city of hate, was that there were a lot of really great student movements going on in the city, especially surrounding integration. And if you remember, there was this diminutive civil rights leader, Juanita Kraft. She particularly, and both from a black student and white student perspective, was this figure. And there were some amazing things that happened. And you know this, it happened everywhere. There were some students from Southern Methodist University who had gone to do a lunch counter sit-in along with some black students. And to get them out of there, the guy who was running the lunch counter began spraying pesticide over their heads. And it was, I guess some sort of statement as well. We need to fumigate the place, if you will. And it was not, contextually, and I really believe this, really effective journalism is done with an understanding of context and history. It just must be done that way. It's far more fair. It's easier to script history in black and white. But given the context, that must have been an extraordinarily, courageous thing to do in Dallas, the last major city to resist integration, cross burnings, former national headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan. The mayor, I forgot to mention this, the mayor of Dallas in 1960 was a former member of the Ku Klux Klan. The probably the most prominent building in Dallas, folks who have been there, maybe you've seen this, it's beautiful, there's a building called the Magnolia Building, and on top of it is the city symbol, the unofficial city symbol, it's Pegasus. And it's this giant glowing, red neon sign, and it seems at night to be flying over the city, Pegasus. It's beautiful. But that building where it sits, was built by the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. And so I'm not answering your question entirely, but students were involved. They've really been forgotten in a lot of ways. And probably something I did incorrect was not to find them, but I kept it more centered on some of the leaders of the movement. And in terms of your second question, which is a really good one, a really important one, when you're doing this book is written in present tense, which is like playing with fire when you're writing, in my opinion. You could really go off the rails, and the temptation really is to take literary license. It's because it's present tense. I wasn't there. I was in the third grade in a Catholic elementary school in New York City listening to the news in grave tones being broadcast out of a little mesh speaker up on the wall. I didn't understand all of it, but I knew something grave, and the long faces at home when we gathered around the TV to see the live images, the horrific things that later occurred with Oswald. But we decided that the best thing to do was to identify a number of prisms through whom, which we could tell the story of the city. And to really boil it down, it became easy in some way because of the strident nature of some of them, but we really said for effective storytelling purposes, we would find 8, maybe 10 at the end of the day, and that we would only really rely upon them if we had first-hand information from them, to wit, oral histories or their personal archives, their own papers. And I suppose just this sounds very practical and I hope it doesn't sound too craven, but it made it easy for us because we could go out and try to use them to recreate that. They're certainly their lives, and then what we think they were doing to the city, not for it, but to it, because it was done in their own words. So we have, I should probably add it up, but I have 500 footnotes or something. We really wanted to make sure that everything was accounted for. I know that didn't answer your question in... Did it? Okay. Well, you're kind. Thank you.
And we had another question up here.
I really enjoyed your talk.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Put in context a major event, which we had probably forgotten a lot of the details.
Well, thank you for saying that.
That's very important. I was wondering what was the role of the journalists in managing disinformation?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, specifically, people might have a difference of opinion on how someone had done something, but there's some specific disinformation things that were here, like the first marriage, and then also Obama with his birth certificate, and it doesn't seem that anything that the victim can do can make it better.
Yeah.
So I think that it may fall more less on the victim to justify his own actions and more on the way that journalists.
I want to please come back with me to my journalism classes at the University of Texas at Austin, because you would lead an effective discussion. It's so important, and it goes to agenda setting and bias and where it begins. I just, you know, I'm not trying to curry favor with you, but journalists have biases.
Substantiating claims that are made before they report them.
Unequivocally, You know what... I'll try to answer this in an anecdotal fashion because perhaps that's a more interesting way to do it too. But I believed as I began doing work on this book with my colleague that there was a parallel media universe, and I'm not wearing a tinfoil hat or getting into any conspiracy theories too much maybe, but there was truly an alternative media. There was another media, and the biggest window for me in that was the black newspaper in town. It was called the Dallas Express. And as an exercise, I would take out that day's issue of it from 1962, let's say, and then the Dallas Morning News, which was the legacy or more, you know, mainstream, larger paper. And it was as if I was reading two different accounts of the Daily News. It just really was. And I didn't really know which one to believe. I had my suspicions. But somewhere maybe in the middle is where the truth was. So it was very, very difficult. And someone just wrote in the American Spectator magazine that there was no extremism in-house at the Dallas Morning News. It was actually written, it just came out a few days ago, in response to our book, saying that our contention that there was extremism at the Dallas Morning News is just false, and that this writer said I was there. In fact, he really wasn't there. He came in 1973, so things had changed a lot. I'm not giving you a really good answer. I almost feel that when you read an article somewhere, that there should be a biography of the writer right after the byline, and it tells you a lot about them, where they went to school, how they were shaped, and throw in who they voted for too, just for grins. Maybe that might help me. But I think, you know, contextually, I had to filter that through. It became very easy. I thoroughly disagree with this guy who wrote this article. In fact, he was a former colleague of mine. I know who it is, and I respect him. But he was absolutely wrong. There was extremism emanating from that paper. And I read. I need some cult deprogramming now. I read every editorial in the Dallas Morning News in that time period, and they just seemed to increase in vitriol. And again, it's extremism. I hope you see that I've been somewhat careful in using the word right-wing extremism. There was left-wing extremism too, and I'm now completely veering. My students tell me I do this all the time, so forgive me. But I'm gonna raise something that I it wouldn't surprise me if some of you aren't thinking. It's like, well, Bill, nice presentation, loved your slideshow. Thanks for coming all the way from the great state of the Lone Star State. But isn't it true that a leftist killed President Kennedy? Isn't it an avowed Marxist? So how does that cotton? What's your theory on that? And I think I did say this a little bit earlier. I think someone as impressionable as he, who was reading these things in the media, reading the militant communist literature and reading the Dallas Morning News, it just, and again, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not qualified to make this leap to connect the dot, but I can't help but feel, it's just my opinion, that he was influenced by this environment, this swirl, and this abandonment of reasoned discourse. It's easier said than done, isn't it? I think we're learning that, to go back to the very good question about 2013. It probably is harder. I'm not an elected official, but it is my opinion. I think they could have tried a little harder these last few weeks to get along and figure something else out. But that's as political as I hope to get. I know I didn't effectively answer your question, but in terms of the media's role, there were several versions of these stories welling up there, and the media really did have a big influence at that time in people's perceptions of Kennedy.
Okay, I think we have time for, is there one more question? Okay, we have time for one more question, and then I want to just say that books are for sale right in the hallway by Nicola, and we will be having a book signing right after, so we hope to see
you. Do you mind if I just say something just for 10 seconds? And forgive me. I just met a fascinating gentleman, and forgive me if I mispronounce your name, George Perrault. George was kind enough to introduce himself to me just earlier, and that he gave me a photograph of himself at President Kennedy. He was in the honor guard during President Kennedy's lying in state day. I'm not describing it correctly, but it's an amazing bit of history that you were there as people paid tribute to him, and he fascinating. So thank you for mentioning. I meant to do that earlier to draw attention to you. So thank you.
So here we are at the 50th anniversary of the assassination. And I'm sure that the city of Dallas has all sorts of sort of solemn and dignified events planned.
Yeah, they do.
But sort of beneath the surface of how they're marking the occasion, how do they interpret the events, what happened 50 years ago, in terms of the broader popular culture or wider culture in Dallas?
Yeah. It's another good question. Thank you. When I moved to Dallas, I moved there in 1983. Again, I was staggered by the fact that it hadn't been cordoned off, that there hadn't been it hadn't been hermetically sealed. There hadn't been a bubble put over the whole area. And the reason I bring that up again is that Dallas, unequivocally, I just know this from living there and working on stories about this specific matter that you mentioned, just didn't know how to address it. They were just torn up about it. Should we ignore it? Should we make it go away? Should we have a small nod to it? And it took decades. It took decades of really roiling debate and resistance to finally create in the Texas School Book Depository. If you ever go to the city, some of you might have and have been there. It's now, I think, the number one tourist attraction in the city. I hope this doesn't seem perversely jocular, but before that, I think it had been South Fork Ranch, where the television show Dallas had been filmed. And so the Texas School Book Depository has been turned into something called the Sixth Floor Museum. I'm not a museum expert. I'm not qualified to critique them, but it seems to be done in a dignified way and a sensible way. And most people I've talked to have visited it. Seem to think it's appropriate. But the point of bringing that up is that it took decades. There wasn't a museum there, really, one that really tried to address it in a deep way. And after the Kennedy assassination, some of you again might know this, there were a lot of stories about people traveling around the country and people would just, where are you from? And people would lie. They'd say, I'm from Houston. Or somewhere else, probably outside of Texas even, because Texas was being assailed. And there was shame, there was embarrassment, there was fear. I got lucky in some of my journalism work to travel, and I was in Moscow in the 1990s, and I was on an elevator in Moscow, and the elevator that I was on wasn't really working that well. I was going real slow. And so I just began talking to the people next to me, and maybe I just looked like I was from somewhere else, I don't know. And they said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "I'm from Dallas, Texas." And the first thing these folks did was go like this. They formed their index finger and thumb and then went like this and said, "Kennedy, Kennedy." And that staggered me. This was in 1990. So I'm not answering your question, I think, very effectively. I'm trying to. It's still there. It's still there. It's still there in the marrow. Again, as I say, the DNA, it hasn't gone away. What happened is that folks really coalesced around the notion we finally need to address it, almost from a spiritual level, this cathartic level. But as well, the early impulses were that we needed to address it from a fiscal level. It's not good for business. There's an amazing, again, I'm biased because I think everything in my book is amazing, but there's an amazing moment, a very poignant moment in our book toward the very end, where immediately in the wake of the assassination, some business leaders in Dallas sent a note to Jacqueline Kennedy, the widow of the president, and asked her, "Would you please do some public relations work on behalf of the city, because now Dallas is reviled. Dallas is known as the city that pulled the trigger that killed your husband and killed the president of the United States. Can you come out publicly and say Dallas isn't that bad?" And our research indicated that she never responded. So that sense has lingered, and Dallas has recovered. People have written mere books putting the entire city of Dallas on Sigmund Freud's couch, saying that it had to go through this catharsis, and that the Dallas Cowboys football team helped to so-called America's team. That's for getting some other football teams around the country. But that it maybe directed attention away from it. And Dallas is home to a number of big Fortune 500 companies. George W. Bush lives in Dallas and chose to go to Dallas after his presidency. So, it's gone away, but as I maintain it, it's never really gone away. And there are still people there. It is 50 years old, but there are people who are alive then who were irrevocably changed by it and are still somewhat ashamed by it. Did that even come close? Okay, thank you.
Okay, we want to thank Bill for coming.
Oh, thanks a lot. Thank you.
And again, the books are for sale just outside. He'll be signing the books up here. And please fill out an evaluation form as you leave. But most important, thank you for coming today.
Thank all of you. Thank you very much.